had some frigid temperatures here in recent days in the state of Wisconsin, some wind chill advisories and some snow. Not enough snow, I don't think, in southern Wisconsin for sure, but we've had some snow. It's winter, of course, but how does this season compare to previous years? We'll talk about that with our two guests, one of them with us right now, Steve Ackerman. Steve is Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, so he probably had a little interest in what Victor Gujo and Tim Donahue were just talking about. Sure, he's well aware of that, but he's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and one of our weather guys. The other weather guy, John Martin, will be with us soon. He's a professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. But first, we welcome Steve Ackerman. Steve, welcome.
Hey, Larry. How's it going?
Going well. And I want to let people know, if you have a question or comment as we move along, please do call in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a look at winter trends, if you have, if you'd like here, Steve. Last week, Wisconsin saw temperatures well below zero. Wind chill advisories were also issued. Which parts of the state have been the lowest temperatures so far this winter?
So that's a good question. Typically, up in north, as you would expect, do have the colder temperatures than we would down south. For us, for the month, for most of Wisconsin and the Great Lakes region, for the month of January, which we're just finishing up, we were about 3 to 4 degrees. The average temperature was below normal. And we saw below normal high temperatures and below normal minimum temperatures as well. And precipitation for most of the state in January was about 50 to 75% of normal. Now, December, northern Wisconsin had some good snowfall, good precipitation, so they're doing okay. But down south, we're definitely below what we would normally expect for snowfall.
I imagine the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, when we're talking about these low temperatures, how much of that is Wisconsin versus is global warming having an impact there?
Yeah, it's having an impact in two ways. One way is the average wintertime temperature. It is rising by about a degree, I think, is what Wiki came up with. The other thing that we're seeing, and it's attributed to global warming again, is those real cold nights, we're just not getting them anymore. It's just too warm to get those cold nights. So our record temperature for Madison was minus 37 degrees, set back in the 1800s. And we hadn't seen anything close to that. You know, since I've been in Wisconsin, I think the coldest I've had in terms of temperatures is minus 26. And that was the end of January in 2019, so a few years ago. But we haven't, the only way we get down to those really minus 30 degree temperatures is through the wind chill. So what it feels like, it's not what the temperature really is.
You mentioned wind chill, and Bob in Superior has a question relating to that, I believe. So let's go to Bob. Bob, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. Long time, first time.
Oh, good.
And I love the weather guys.
Good.
Two years ago, in February, you had some very cold weather downstate, and you had a long discussion about how unusual it was, and wind chill, and a listener called in and said, years ago, I walked to work 2 days in a row, and the wind chill was over 100 below zero. And I could hear, I don't know which weather guy it was, but whoever spoke, I could hear the skepticism in his voice. He said, do you remember the date? And I don't know how old these weather guys are, but Larry, you're my age. they changed the formula in 2001.
Yeah,
that's true.
I remember days in the 70s and 80s. I think the worst I saw was minus 111. But if you had the same conditions nowadays, they'd probably say it's like minus 70 or 75.
You know, that's an interesting point. And Bob, thank you for calling. Steve, talk about that for a bit.
Yeah, boy, that I would not want to experience that, because your flesh would freeze within a couple of minutes, I think, at that kind of temperature, because the wind chill is talking about how fast you cool down. And Bob's right. We used to measure the wind chill. It was determined in Antarctica. They would hang up a bucket of water and watch how long it took to freeze and as a function of the wind speed and the temperature, and then figured it out. But then more recently, in the last couple of decades, they went to theoretical calculations and looking at what that cooling power of the wind is. And that definitely changed in terms of getting really super cold wind chill factors. But I've never experienced anything below probably about minus 40, minus 45 wind chill while I was living in Wisconsin. But boy, minus 100, that would be, I'm sure John was the one who said what date that was, because I'm sure he will want to look it up.
Well, with the way they figured the wind chill then, it actually came out sounding worse or being worse than the new way that they figure it.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that was the case for the really cold wind chills, that they went to the theoretical modeling instead of experimentation, that it, you know, we didn't get as extreme wind chills.
Well, I was trying to remember, and I don't really. I shouldn't even bring it up because I don't remember the coldest wind chill I've ever been in. But I know it was. We had some dandies when I was a youngster, or a lot younger than I am right now. Anyway.
Yeah, I think it was in the 80s that we had minus 40, and I remember it because we were doing an experiment out at Truax Field, and we had the NASA pilots in, and they had asked for, it was the winter time, and they had asked for temperatures, and they saw a wind chill of minus 44, and, you know, they were like, they just said, we don't go out in that weather. Well, neither do we.
Oh, boy. Bob, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. You can join in to 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, recently released its three-month temperature outlook for the U.S. And these data look at February, March, and April. I'm wondering what they're predicting for Wisconsin.
So what they're predicting for Wisconsin, this is a La Nina year. And so when they do these seasonal forecasts or three-month forecasts, you know, if you don't have a strong climate signal or circulation signal like an El Nino, it becomes a little more uncertain. So with that in mind, with regard to temperature, they're forecasting that we have an equal chance of it being normal, above normal, or below normal temperatures for most of Wisconsin and the Great Lake regions. And in terms of precipitation, there's a more likely probability that precipitation will be above normal. So that's a good thing if you're, you know, looking for more precipitation, and particularly in snowfall. You know, it may be coming. We haven't had it yet, but it may be coming.
Yeah, it's really, really dry. I don't know how far behind we are on snowfall?
In southern Wisconsin, we're about 50% below. Northern Wisconsin, you know, they had some good snowfall in December, so they may be closer to average. Having said that, you know, the lakes for ice skating down here were great, right? So that's the advantage of not having that kind of snowfall.
Absolutely. Well, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison and a professor in the Department of Atmospheric Oceanic Sciences, one of our guests. John Martin will be joining us after the news. John's also a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Lots of callers online. There'll probably still be a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Again, we'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our weather guys. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. The weather guys are back with us today. We now have John Martin joining us, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry.
And Steve Ackerman, we've already introduced you to, the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies.
I was.
He was, but he's moved away from that a little bit, and he is now vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, but also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So talking with them about the weather, and we have a number of callers online already, so I think we just go right to the phones here, and Mary in Menominee is up first. Mary, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Lately, I've been noticing pink sunrises, even when there's good weather, and I'm wondering if there's ash from the Tonga volcano floating over us.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't think the ash has made it this far to do that. But, you know, Mary, we've been noticing it too. So some beautiful sunsets and beautiful sunrises. And a lot of it was associated with the, you know, the clouds in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, yeah, certainly true.
Yeah.
But I don't think the ash cloud has gotten this far.
Not yet, anyway. Yeah, there you go, Mary. Thank you. Bill in Prairie du Chien, your turn.
While you were talking about really cold temperatures, you could look up January 9th of 1977. There was areas where it was 60 below zero, so I don't know what the wind chill would have been. The tires on my car were frozen so solid that it took a half a mile for them to get round again.
You know, and I have to ask, does it matter what the wind chill was? If it's minus 60, you're not going outside anyway.
Well, my car must have started because I actually drove it that day. But
that's
amazing.
I've heard at minus 70, most gasolines turn into some kind of gelatin. So you were just above that temperature. That happens in Siberia and, you know, Alaska when they get their really miserable cold spells. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, 60 below. Yeah, that's cold. Thanks, Bill. Well, Helen in West Salem, we'll go to you. Hi, Helen.
Yes, I'm calling because the person talked about the 70s and it was cold. Our kids were going off to school and buses went. It was minus 40 and our thermometer broke. It never registered below that and it was done for. But anyway, back, I don't know if they still do, but they wore over their faces cutouts for the eyes and so forth. And they went off, and it was fine. But my other comment is the wind chill. They didn't talk about wind chill back then. And obviously, if it's 40 below or 30 below or whatever, it's going to be cold, and you dress for it. So what difference does it make what the wind chill is? That's all. That's just my comment.
Helen, thanks. John, a comment?
Well, it does make a difference. I mean, I don't mean to sound flippant, but it doesn't make a difference beyond a threshold, I guess. You know, your skin is going to freeze with contact with air that's minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit, still air temperature. You're not going to be able to escape that. If it's minus 30 with a wind chill of minus 50, you might be able to escape it if you are aware of the fact that you should cover up all of your skin. So it's a useful thing to know because it does actually testify to the human physiological response to the combination of temperature and wind speed.
Yeah. And minus 40 is that magic temperature where minus 40 Fahrenheit equals minus 40 Celsius.
Yeah.
It's really kind of magical temperature.
And I've heard of people spitting and having their spit freeze, you're in Alaska or someplace, or throwing a pail of water and it freezes in the air before it hits the ground. Then we're talking about temperatures like those.
Yeah.
For sure. You know, talking about that, Mike from Milwaukee emailed, wanted to know if wind chill affects the heating bills in our homes.
I don't think directly, right? Because the wind chill is telling you how fast you cool down. Where it can influence it indirectly, I would say, is if you have a real cold wind chill, that means you have a wind. And so if the wind is buffering your home and you got, you know, cracks It's not well sealed, and the cold air will get in that way.
Mm.
Yeah, that makes good sense to me. Bill from Oregon sent an email. It says the easiest way to identify the coldest years is to look up the years that icebreakers were required on Lake Michigan. The first time Lake Michigan froze over during Bill's lifetime was the winter of 76 and 77. Milwaukee was below zero for 30 days. Wind chills minus 40 to minus 60 were common and occasionally exceeded minus 100.
Wow. Yeah, that was a brutal, brutal winter. There's no doubt about that. The southern and eastern Great Lakes took a real hit in January of 77 and even part of December 76. Yeah, it's true.
So it takes
and
a bit.
I was living in Colorado then, and while this area was really cold, Colorado was really warm.
Yeah.
In the winter. I was biking to work at like 11 o'clock at night because I had to go up and run a computer job. It was that warm. That I
Well, it was plenty cold here, that's for sure. And Lake Michigan doesn't always freeze over, I guess, completely.
No. Certainly not close to freezing right now.
No, it's not going to freeze. I don't think it'll freeze over completely anyway. Rosie in Ashland, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rosie. Thank you for calling.
You're very welcome. I believe it was in a Jack London book, possibly The Story to Build a Fire, where he reported the rule of 30, which is at 30 below zero and 30-mile-an-hour winds, exposed skin freezes in 30 seconds.
Mm.
Wow.
Is that about right, do you think?
I bet that's a liberal estimate. I bet it's shorter than that, but I don't know. It's probably right in the ballpark, though. Yeah, it's that fast.
Yeah, and it's been a long time since I read that book.
Mm.
She was talking about, To Start a Fire.
Mm.
That was a
very sad ending there.
Well, yeah,
very. Away for those who haven't read it yet.
You can join in, too. Rosie, thank you. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So what data, we're looking at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration before you got here, John, and recently released its three-month temperature outlook for the U.S. and looked at February, March, and April. And Steve, you were saying that it was pretty much six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yeah.
Mm.
About whether it was
going either way, above the same or below. But precipitation, they're looking at the probably being above normal.
Mm.
So we are here in Wisconsin. Looking back at that, we don't really know then what's gonna happen.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. And we know what we want to happen. We need to get some precipitation down here. We haven't had any substantially for many months. And it's I hope we do have kind of a little bit wetter spring than normal to kind of get things back a little closer to normal. But if it comes at the wrong time, it's bad for the farmers. If it comes at the right time, it's perfect. So, and I wish I was more of an expert in that. I don't know what that timing really is, but it's not good to have little snow cover, though persistent, thankfully. But it'd be nice to have a deeper snow cover.
Yeah, for sure.
And the seasonal forecast is a lot different than the 2-3 weekly forecast or 2-day, 3-day weekly forecast.
Yeah.
You just know it's just a lot harder to do. And that's why they go with the probability of being at above or below normal rather than trying to get specific.
What data did they use for that anyway? How do they use those data, or what data do they use?
I think some of the projections are they're continuously probably changing the way in which they make that projection because we're learning more about how, let's say, tropical convective activity that comes in various manifestations, various kinds of cycles, has an impact on the mid-latitudes at various times of year and depending on the intensity. Then you've got the tropical sea surface temperatures that matter. So I think as years in the length of my career, the number of things that are actually better understood in terms of giving you some sense of a projection a month or two in advance has vastly improved. So I don't know exactly what the formula is now, but as Steve says, it's nothing at all like taking the initial conditions of around the globe today and just running forward with a numerical code. It's a little bit more statistical than that, well, considerably more statistical than that.
Yeah.
And we do know what doesn't go into it. The Farmer's Almanac prediction.
That's correct. That's correct.
That one of the predictors. Well, why do these data matter?
What do you mean?
Well, you know, we're doing these forecasts, but why do these data forecast data matter, make any difference?
Well, I guess I would say it from this perspective. I think if one can imagine that they're getting better, then they actually adds to the list of human activities that can be informed in a better way than they used to be by such forecasts. But there's no way to know if they're getting better unless you keep track of the forecasts you made and then compare them against reality. So step one is to verify or most of the time realize that your forecast did not verify 3 months out. But if the percentage of hits gets higher, then it's more likely that you'll be able to say something useful to businesses, municipalities, various other interests at a longer time range.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's probably it.
Farmers too. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
Good afternoon.
You're right.
I got a little snippet you guys might like. This was back, and I lived down in Waukegan, Illinois, and not so far from Lake Michigan. I was in a house where there's really nothing around it, no garage, and it was very cold. It could have been 20 to 25 below, and this was back in the late 80s. I went outside to turn my key in the car, and it just went whoop. I was wondering what in the world is going on, because it normally starts with a little four-cylinder Toyota. So I did one of those V8 things. I hit myself on the head. I forgot to take the heavyweight oil. It was 20W50. It was like cement.
I was going to say.
Yeah. I put a lighter weight oil in the wintertime, and I just forgot. So I had to go to the parts store and get a dipstick heater, and it took 2 days, 48 hours for
how do you flush it out of your system, because it probably congeals in the system too. How did you get it out?
I had to go, I usually do it myself, but it's so cold out I had to go to a shop and have them, but I had to drive it around a little bit because that stuff was like cement.
Yeah, to warm it up. Yeah. Oh my god, wow. That's brutal.
Oh, man, Mark, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And nowadays, these synthetic oils that they've got, probably that may be a less of an issue, Steve, you think?
I would guess so. I mean, you would think that they would design for that. Those synthetic oils are a lot more expensive.
And the last time I got it put in my car, no one mentioned anything about the cold temperature. So you'd think if they did have it designed for that, and you're living in Wisconsin, they'd tell you, hey, you can go down to minus 30 without worrying about your oil. So maybe they haven't, which is a surprise. It's sort of like Apple. That'll be the next innovation, even though they could have done it 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think there are permutations depending on region of the country for some of those oils that they're actually designed for Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Dakota, and so forth.
Oh, I believe that. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So there's a lot of news recently about permafrost and problems associated with losing the permafrost in the Arctic. John, what is permafrost and talk about it? It's apparently not permanent, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's right. It's kind of a weird contradiction in a sense, but the way that it's been historically, what's called permafrost is called that because it lasts throughout the year as frozen soil. And it's not all the way to the top of the surface. It goes down some distance below, depending on your latitude. But the fact that it's receding at locations around the globe, especially high latitude locations, is dangerous only because I think that permafrost traps some organic material in the ice, and that organic material includes, I think mostly it's methane that is a product of some of the decay of this organic material, and that methane stays locked up in the ice. It's called clathrates, I think, or something. And when that ice that contains the methane melts, then the methane escapes into the gaseous form into the atmosphere, and it's a very potent greenhouse gas. So the more that the permafrost melts away, the more methane is added by virtue of it being melted, and the more intense the greenhouse retention of infrared energy becomes. So it's kind of a positive feedback cycle.
And I've read that the Arctic is warming faster than any place else on the planet, and its permafrost is starting to thaw.
Yeah, that's true.
Why would the Arctic, enlighten me here, why would the Arctic be warming faster than any place else on the planet?
It has a few special characteristics that other parts of the planet don't have. One of them is it has a large ice extent. And if you can put snow on top of that ice while the sun is up, that really allows for a substantial amount of reflection of incoming solar radiation. Meager though it may be, it doesn't get, you know, put into the accounting books. In the modern era, there's a little less extensive ice, and it probably, some fraction of it for some time of the year when the sun's up, won't be snow covered. And so it's easier for the sunlight to be absorbed by the ice and then even by the ocean underneath. And that just adds heat to the high latitudes that it didn't get before. And there's no place else on Earth that has that kind of sensitivity to that degree. And the way things are rolling right now, it makes the high latitudes warm faster. And when the water warms up, it keeps the air a little bit warmer near it compared to the past as well.
So that's why it warms faster there than in probably any place else in the world.
Yeah, a whole bunch of circumstances lead into that, yeah.
Wow. The air, somebody wondered about the dry air in the wintertime. Why does the air in our home seem so dry in the winter?
Because we want to stay warm. what happens is, as we were talking earlier with the wind chill, a little bit different, but, you know, our air has cracks and in the house, and the air, outside air gets in, or we open the door and cold air in the wintertime gets in. And so once that air gets into the house, and the house is always cooling down, we turn on the heat to warm it up. And so when it really dries out, one way of measuring how dry the air is the difference between the actual temperature and the dew point temperature. So the dew point temperature is the temperature to which air has to be cooled to get dew to form, right? Which we usually see that in the fall in particular. When the dew point and the temperature are the same, then you have a relative humidity of 100%. And the further those temperatures are apart, the lower the relative humidity. So when the house cools down, either by just normal processes or colder air coming in, the dew point doesn't change. But when we turn on the heat, we increase the temperature in the house. And so that makes a difference between the temperature and the dew point temperature in your house larger, which makes the relative humidity lower. Mm. In some cases, you know, relative humidity in the house could be 10-20%, you know, which is like a desert. It's like living in a desert. And your plants will respond to that. If you have plants, you'll notice they'll wilt, and you'll have to put a lot more water on them than you normally would do in the summer, for sure.
Yeah, and so then we resolve that by trying to put more moisture into the air.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. So we have humidifiers that'll put more moisture in the air. Prior to COVID, you could have a really big party, have a lot of people come over. They're all going to breathe and sweat, and that'll add humidity to the air as well. Mm-hmm.
And somebody else wonders about climate change. Is that what is affecting the permafrost?
Yeah, so the general warming that we were just talking about with the Arctic is causing the permafrost to warm up.
Yeah.
And melt. Or I guess it melts?
Yeah, melts.
Frost. It doesn't really melt because it's not a liquid, right? So it'd be...
Well, there's ice in it, I guess.
Oh, right, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that the ice pot melts, yeah.
Mary in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Mary.
Hello?
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, I was wondering about methane locked in the ocean bottom. Is there more of that? And I'll hang up.
Okay, is the ocean warming too? And is that going to create the problem if there's methane locked in the bottom of the ocean?
I don't know the degree to which methane is locked in the ocean. It is locked in some of those northern lakes. And so we see methane coming out of some of those more northern lakes. Methane bubbles as well. In the frozen ice, you can actually see them.
Yeah. And from what I understand with respect to the ocean, I don't know if I've heard anything, as Steve says, about methane in the ocean, but there's bound to be somebody who knows a lot about that, and it's not me. But I know that the ocean ability to soak up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is somewhat questioned. We don't know how close it is to being saturated to that, because water is really good at absorbing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, but we don't know if we've pushed the ocean to the brink of being saturated or not, and that's a big mystery, I guess. And the ocean mixing from the deep ocean to the top of the ocean can be one of the keys to understanding that. And as far as I know, that's not resolved yet.
So, so that's another thing to worry about, kind of.
we may be playing with a deck that's already full. And even if we're not, it takes sometimes 1,000 years for that bottom water to get to the surface. So it's out of play for long enough that it might not come to the rescue, even though it does come. But not to the rescue.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, on that happy note.
Sorry.
We're out of time. Stephen John, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. We'll look forward to your next visit, the last Monday of February. Oh, my gosh.
I'll do it.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, as is our other guest, John Martin. He's also a professor there as well, and he's teaching a class this semester, so he joined us a little later than normal. Thanks for listening. We'll talk about exercise science tomorrow and what it takes to get injured athletes back into the Olympics, those 2022 Olympics. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.